Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of November 5th, 2018. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you each week, as always, by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state Society of CPAs. I got back this week. I was in Boise, and then I came back and I did a session here in Phoenix for the Federal Tax Institute for the Arizona Society of CPAs. And I'm actually back in Phoenix recording here on Saturday, getting ready to go to Portland, Oregon for their tax conference on Monday and Tuesday. And then do a couple of sessions in Tucson later this week on current federal tax developments, and then Arizona taxes and Arizona ethics, all those great things happening. So from Portland, Phoenix, Tucson, and the following week on to Minneapolis for the Minnesota tax conference, big tax conference, if you haven't been to that one. And then following that, I'll be doing some sessions here in Phoenix for the Arizona Society before heading on back and getting back on the road following Thanksgiving, when I'll be doing sessions down in the U.S. Virgin Islands. So, hey, you know, U.S. Virgin Islands, the end of November, not a bad place to go. I will admit that. So we'll be looking at all of those little things. But this week, we have a few things to do. First thing we have this week is we're going to discuss with you the fact that the IRS has released the inflation-adjusted qualified plan numbers for 2019. It's a little bit later than we've gotten them normally. But it is the first of the series of inflation-adjusted numbers that the IRS will be releasing for 2019. These are the ones, though, that deal with your qualified plan issues and IRA issues. We'll talk about an IRS draft Form 990-T that was released on October 16th, the instructions on it, and the guidance they're giving regarding what's known as the parking lot tax. We'll talk about the students who lost their second attempt at getting relief for their travel expenses coming to the U.S., they worked over the summer. We'll talk about why, even though this was under a summer work program, they were denied their deduction for travel to the U.S., and they lost again after trying to appeal from the tax court decision we discussed a couple of years ago, or actually last year. We've now got them losing at the D.C. Circuit. We have information that a blue book may actually be coming soon for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And finally, we'll talk about a taxpayer who was denied relief from liability for tax due on a joint return that the court found she didn't actually file, but she's still liable for the tax on it. We'll talk about how she got in that predicament. Well, to start out, let's talk about those IRS inflation numbers. This is a time of year we begin to get inflation-adjusted numbers from the IRS for various purposes. And this year, you know, came out this time right at the beginning of November. Now, these numbers usually came out in mid-October, so it looks like the IRS may be running about 2 weeks behind in what they normally do, because usually mid-October, we would get the plan numbers. Late October, we would get the other inflation-adjusted numbers. This year, it's late October, we're getting the plan numbers. And by the way, please remember, these numbers did not change how we compute their inflation-adjusted amounts. They are still to the old CPI, the main urban CPI, not to the chain CPI. The other numbers are tied to the chain CPI, so we'll see if that delays them further. But in any event, we now at least know what our qualified plan numbers are. They were released in IRS Notice 2018-83 on November the 1st. There's also a news release up on the IRS website that describes these numbers. The key changes we have for this year, and they're not huge changes, but they did jump some this year. So we do have some jump in them. The maximum allocation in a defined contribution plan to a single employee's account, not counting the catch-up contribution, is $56,000 for 2019. The maximum catch-up remains at $6,000 for that contribution. However, the maximum you can defer via traditionally 401k or various other deferral mechanisms and other like governmental plans, etc., $19,000 will be the number for 2019. Again, up slightly, not hugely, but up slightly from the 2018 numbers. The maximum benefits you can fund for in a defined benefit plan is going to go up to $225,000 now annually. The maximum compensation you can consider in your calculations is going to $280,000 in 2019. The simple deferral actually finally is getting a bump. It's been a few years, but if you have a simple plan, probably a simple IRA plan, your maximum deferral is going to go to $13,000 in 2019. Additional things that have changed for this year, for 19, a highly compensated employee number will go to 125,000. Now, as you should be aware, in most cases, for those of us that have closely held enterprises. The key issue there is not how much money they make, but the fact they have ownership interest, which causes some issues. The IRA, maximum IRA contribution will rise to $6,000. So that's a bit of a jump from what we've had before. IRA deductible IRAs begin to phase out for those who are covered by an employer plan at $64,000 to $74,000 if you're a single or head of household. So over that range, the deduction will phase out. If you're doing married filing a joint return and you're covered, rather than your spouse, it's you. Your spouse could be covered, not covered, but you are covered. You begin to phase out between $103,000 and $123,000. And if you're married, filing a joint return, you're not covered by a plan, but your spouse is covered by a plan, then the phase out for yours goes between $193,000 and $203,000. Again, those are the phase outs where we see us lose the deductible IRA and it goes to non-deductible. Also, we need to say with Roth IRAs, we have some changes there. Again, they'll get the $6,000, same as a regular IRA. But the Roth phase out, remember, Roths are still these things that you cannot make a contribution to at all if your income is too high. And for this year, the phase out for a Roth is going to begin at $193,000 in 2019. I shouldn't say this year, I should say 19. And for those who are other filing status, $122,000. Remember, earlier this year, we discussed the IRS is reluctantly, but apparently quasi-officially, agreeing that one can do the backdoor Roth IRA, which is kind of crazy because if you can do that, in generally, the whole fact you convert or not to a Roth IRA regardless of income, but the contributions are still capped, doesn't really make sense, but it's still the way the law works. The backdoor Roth, for those who've never heard of that program, is where if you do not currently have an IRA, if you currently have an IRA, this doesn't work nearly as well. But if you do not currently have an IRA and you cannot make a Roth contribution because, let's say, your income's $500,000, what you make is a non-deductible IRA contribution, because I'm assuming you're covered by a plan, so deductible is not on the table. And then shortly thereafter, you then convert that IRA to a Roth IRA. There'll be very little earnings to pick up. And since it's a conversion rather than a contribution, you're able to do it regardless of your income. Again, that option is not affected by the 193-122 limitations. All of that kind of goes away. Nevertheless, we have the plan numbers for next year, so you can start looking at how much could be stuck away in a retirement plan for 2019 and begin discussing that issue with your clients. We have another little issue coming up here that I found a few CPAs, when I've talked to them in updates over the past couple of weeks, it's actually been shocking to a number of CPAs who missed this little detail buried in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, though a whole lot of churches have not missed it. And this is regarding the fact the IRS put out on October the 16th, and we were all a little busy then, so we may not have noticed it happening, but there was a nice article on tax notes this week regarding to it, and a letter to the editor that went over a specific point. So it actually is kind of a useful thing here because people began noticing that inside of here is information on this thing we call the parking lot tax. Now, the parking lot tax is something that you have to kind of understand in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It's really related to two provisions. First, if you look inside some of the minor issues regarding fringe benefits and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, Congress decided that certain fringe benefits they would not make taxable to employees. My guess is they decided not to make them taxable because then employees would see them in their W-2. They'd pay tax on them. They'd be upset. They'd claim a tax increase. Okay, Congress doesn't want that. But Congress wanted to get some money from that. So what Congress did was took away the deduction for providing certain benefits to your employees. One of those things they took away were transportation benefits, including the provision by an employer of free parking for their employees. So, first step is, which a lot of people apparently have missed, and by the way, the problem is nobody really knows how to do this, but the theory is you're to figure out the costs that are being deducted by the employer related to the parking that they are providing for free to their employees. And you might think, well, that's not a problem. We don't charge anybody for parking. You know, we're not in a downtown area of a big city. We don't do that sort of thing. No, it doesn't matter. You're still providing free parking, and that parking does cost money. You're saying, we don't get charged separate rent for the parking spaces in the office building we rent space in. And my answer is no, but if you came in tomorrow morning and you discovered that the entire parking lot you're normally parking in was torn up over the weekend by the landlord and brand new wonderful landscaping was put in place, but there was no parking for your office building any longer, would you be a little upset and would you try to claim they had violated your lease? Probably. So presumably you are paying something for the right to park because you certainly would be upset if that parking wasn't there. So presumably if you're leasing that space, you have to allocate a portion of your lease to the parking spaces that you use and then allocate that and figure out how much of those parking spaces are used by your employees and then figure out how much of the rent makes up that and you disallow that deduction. Okay, all well and good. But hey, remember how Congress did this. If you're a not-for-profit organization, you were never claiming deduction on that anyway. So Congress came up with a special provision at 512A7 that provides generally, if you do have this parking lot, if you're providing free parking or other transit benefits to your not-for-profit staff, also deals with certain athletic facilities, a couple of other special issues, but parking lots are the big problem here, that you have to treat that as additional unrelated business income. And it's UBTI, unrelated business taxable income. It's an add back to that. Well, Form 990T gives us some information about this. What's interesting is this Form 990T tells us that we have a simplified filing mechanism for this. If you look at the draft Form 990T, if all your charity has no other unrelated business income, but you do have this parking lot problem and the total value is in excess of $1,000. You know, when that is, by the way, that total value test is $1,000 for this stuff plus the gross income from any unrelated businesses you have. I'm presuming though, if you're going to do the simplified version, you have no other unrelated business. So then we're looking at $1,000 value for the parking lot. If we have $1,000 in parking benefits we're giving to employees, and it depends on how many employees you've got, you know, and what's going on, how many the not-for-profit has, you file the 990T, you fill in just the heading above part one, except for section C, E, H, and I. You complete only the relevant lines in parts three and four, very short fill-in. You're basically telling them how much you're paying for parking lot tax, and you sign it. Now, the catch here, that particular add-on provision of 512A7 is, as I said, added with gross income when you try to come up with how much income you have for purposes of the $1,000 gross income test, after which you would have to file a Form 990T. Well, the problem, of course, is and there was a letter to the editor, to tax analysts, written by Benjamin A. Davidson of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and by Bertram A. Harding of the law offices of Bertram M. Harding, I should say, Jr., law offices of Bertram M. Harding, Jr., that pointed out that the IRS, in a notice that was issued recently, notice issued this summer, 2018-67, in section 8.02, indicated that these payments were not gross income. Now, that notice was dealing with a different part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, specifically the part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that does not allow you to net businesses, you know, separate unrelated businesses, you know, losses from one unrelated business with the income from another. But there is a comment in there that the 512A7 amount is not gross income, and it's not considered actually an unrelated trade or business. So they did point out that the instructions seem to be telling us backdoor that we're going to change the regs for that $1,000 test. Right now, the $1,000 test is based solely on gross income. I would suspect that is a kind of preview. And of course, those two individuals were arguing that they shouldn't change that test. And so if all you had was this, you should be allowed to get out. We don't know what the IRS is going to do. However, you know, they may give some relief. But if you work with any not-for-profits, and by the way, that includes churches that don't file 990s. So they've never had a filing obligation potentially at all if they've not had unrelated business income. They now will have this 990T obligation if there's $1,000. You know, and churches may have significant staff, especially if, as some churches do, like the church I'm with, you know, they also run a preschool. And so they have preschool teachers there, you know, during the week. And so you have to count the value of all those cars, plus the office staff, plus anybody else that's around. So depending upon what type of operations are at, let's say, a church, it may suddenly have to be filing this 990T. The 990T, yeah, something not used to being filed. Certainly take a look at this. Now, the real question comes, how do we value those parking spaces? We still don't have guidance. I still don't know. And remember, that's going to affect your for-profit clients as well as not-for-profit clients, because in theory, we should have a schedule M adjustment on a not-for-profit client for this parking benefit we've been giving employees for years that we now are not going to claim a deduction on. So in any event, keep your eyes open on this one. Next up, we have an appeal. Went to the D.C. Circuit, Wilderberg versus Commissioner, and I'm clobbered that name. There are three names in there, and I think the court intentionally picked the toughest as a lead case. In any event, it's case number 17-1207 from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. It was published on November the 2nd. It's affirming a tax court case, 148-TC-83, issued in 2017, just about a year ago. And that case dealt with these particular students. They are participants in the State Department Summer Work Travel Program. What it is, these are exchange students who are in the U.S. and who are allowed under the special State Department program to stay here and work and earn money over the summer in the U.S. as part of their educational experience. To do that, they have to get a visa, which basically is a visa of the type that says they have a home back in the other country and they plan to return to it. They're not planning to become permanent U.S. residents. So they have this document, they work, they earn money in the summer. Three of these students attempted to claim on their 1040s for the U.S., you know, their U.S. tax income, U.S. income tax returns, that they were filing, that was business travel, that they should be able to claim a deduction for the cost of getting to the U.S. and the cost of going from the U.S., because they were doing that under this special program. They argued for a couple of reasons why it should be that way. One of the reasons they argued was that they, you know, it's not like they don't need to maintain a second home because this visa requires them to say they have a second home, a home they're going back to, they are here temporarily. And they're saying, well, because of that, we have the cost of maintaining two homes. And isn't that really what these, you know, away from home expenses are supposed to cover? And oh, by the way, the IRS publication that goes to us as students also tells us that we should be able to get deductions for some of these away from home expenses. And the court took a look at this. The tax court rejected it. So did the D.C. Circuit. They noted that there was no business reason for the second residence. They said, essentially, you have a second residence, not for any business reason. And even better, your travel wasn't for a business reason. Your travel was here for a personal reason. You came over here primarily to get the education under the exchange program. So that travel was here to do that. You decided to stay over the summer and work through this special State Department program. Fine. But the primary reason for your travel was personal. You know, you don't live, you know, you're not living here. You came over here for educational, personal purposes. For that reason, no current deduction. Interesting case. Obviously, one of those things where they tried and again lost when they went to appeals. And pardon me for just a second. Oh, sorry about that. My travels over the past 2 weeks picked up a bit of a cough, shall I say, a cold on the way over. So we'll hope for the best, but this is becoming, and hopefully I'll make it through the program without too much more trouble. Now, next up is an interesting program, an interesting conversation, or an interesting article. This one was in Tax Notes Today for October 30th of 2018. And this is talking about coming soon, Congress's explanation of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, written by Stephanie Cummings. The blue book we've discussed before has kind of been missing in action, reportedly held hostage because of various concerns over what was in there. Vina Murthy, the Joint Committee on Taxation's Legislative Council, announced that they expect to have this book out by the end of the year. Now, the problem with getting it out, as the article points out, is that this tax bill was passed in a rather interesting and somewhat strange manner. And probably one of the first ones we've seen done this way on tax bills. It's not the first reconciliation bill we ever had. Obviously, those of you who remember back to EGTRA in 2001, that was a reconciliation bill. But that particular bill passed with some Democratic votes, and there was even some hope that it would pass with 60 votes so they wouldn't have to use the reconciliation provision. That was why the sunset got added in after it was clear they couldn't get 60 votes in the Senate. So this is one of the first bills we've had where literally it was one party that drafted the bill entirely. There was no input from the minority side whatsoever. Now that means, of course, that members of the Joint Committee of Taxation, you know, essentially the staff, half the staff, just a little bit less than half the staff, just minority staff, wasn't involved at all. So their claim, of course, is they have no idea what the intent was. The minority, you know, the minority members say they have no idea what the intent was because they weren't allowed into the conversations. That's made it more difficult. There's also been some complaints that they were trying to do technical corrections via the Blue Book. Obviously, those who are writing it say, no, you're just obstructing. We always have a Blue Book. We say what's happening. In any event, apparently we are getting close to getting one out. And the hope, they said, was that it won't be the very end of the year. There are reports, she noted, that her boss, you know, which is the chief there, the you know, head of the Joint Committee staff, has been circulating a draft Blue Book. They are hopeful, as they say, it won't be the very end of the year. So maybe if we cross our fingers in the next few weeks, we'll actually get a formal official Blue Book that has some explanations about how this law is supposed to work. In any event, we'll keep our eyes open for it. We'll try to watch for this as we go forward. The Blue Book would be very helpful in some areas, obviously, because we're still somewhat behind in getting all the regs out that we need. Finally, let's go to a court case. This one is a case where, well, this woman doesn't owe, but actually she does. We'll talk about why. This is a case of Abdelhadi versus Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2018-183, issued on November the 1st. This is a case of somebody who, she had been involved with this gentleman. Apparently, she was involved with him. Then she lived with him. They split for a while. He married someone else, but that fell apart quickly. He got divorced quickly. She then became involved with him again. And so all these things happened. When she became involved with him again in 2004, apparently that year she had very little income. She did not file an income tax return. But this gentleman she was involved with filed a joint return for her with her in 2004. She was not aware one had been filed. He never showed it to her, but he filed a joint return. Okay, obviously claiming, and he claimed a nice refund. The big problem, of course, was she never married this guy until a decade later. So in essence, that was a joint return. She was never where it had been filed. And it wasn't until, you know, a decade later she actually married this guy. Not surprisingly, the 2004 return got examined. Well, maybe, you know, it wasn't for this reason, but obviously, you know, there were issues on it. And they discovered that basically there was over $20,000 of tax due on the 2004 return. As it came down, now, there was also exams for years 14 and beyond where she had been married to him, and she qualified and got innocent spouse relief for those years. She applied for innocent spouse relief for this year, but the IRS denied it. Why? Well, here's the problem. As she said, after she filed this request and when she filed the tax court petition, she wasn't really married to him in 2004. She had no idea the return was filed. She didn't sign the return. And the court said it's very clear it's not her signature on the return. They have her signature on their documents. Doesn't look anything like it. You know, it's not her signature. There's no evidence whatsoever she was ever married. Everybody agreed she was not married to this guy in 2004. She did not sign the joint return. She was not aware the joint return had been filed until the exam got underway. And, you know, all that stuff, fine, we're good. So why did it get turned down? And by the way, and it's his income. It would all be his tax under the standard innocent spouse rules. So why was she turned down? She's turned down because, frankly, there was no joint return. There has to be a joint return to qualify for the relief she had asked for. So the problem is, as the court said, she had filed a standalone petition. She only asked for innocent spouse relief. The court said, that's the one thing we can't give you. You weren't a spouse. You weren't married. You'd already gone through the full exam. You'd already signed off and consented to the assessment. You're not challenging the assessment. And unfortunately, she needed to challenge the assessment for herself because it wasn't her tax at all. I mean, it's not just like in a joint return where it would be her tax by default because we had joint and several liability. But in innocent spouse rules, we can take it away from you. No, this just wasn't her tax at all. But the bad news is she's never requested relief from owing it. She never stated, this is not my tax. You know, there's no liability to me. Rather, she kind of quasi-accepted that liability, but then asked only for innocent spouse relief. By the way, this is the kind of result that only a CPA or an attorney could think makes sense. Because obviously, it's an amount she shouldn't owe, but since she conceded it, she does. And if she did owe it, she could out of it for innocent spouse relief. But because she didn't really owe it, but she only conceded it, and she wasn't really married, she can't get instant spouse relief because only married people get instant spouse relief. So if this woman is slightly confused, she has every reason to be. And if she's slightly cynical about the system, well, that probably has a reason for that too. Suffice it to say, this is how to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Sad part about this is, you know, you have to assume if she had had adequate advice early on, and if she'd had adequate counsel early on, somebody would have figured out that, wait, you weren't married. You know, skip this. We're challenging the assessment. You know, don't sign off on the assessment. We're challenging it because it's not yours. You know, you need to be taken off that. There, you shouldn't be on that thing. It wasn't your return. Well, as we've noted, it's still in the state society CPE season. We are in the middle of it now. You're in the big time. The conferences are starting. As I said, I'm going to be in Oregon this week. I'll be in Minnesota next week. I'm doing New Mexico's conference at the beginning of December. So I've got a bunch coming up. I'll be doing sessions all around the country. Tucson, have a couple of sessions in Phoenix. Actually, those are kind of a break. I'm going to actually do revenue recognition. And then the tax. And then, you know, our fun here with 450, with 451B, and our revenue conformity problem under Tax Cuts and Jobs Act will be my second four-hour class. That one actually is supposed to have been, you know, getting the RevRec system into taxes, but now 451B is the big problem that we have. Also be doing construction contractors here in Phoenix. The week after that, I will be, you know, when I get back to town, I'm doing an out-of-town infirm session. When I get back to Phoenix, I'll be doing the 199 Cap A. Major part of that course is basically all the small business provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It's a course I did in Boise, last week, and I'll be doing that. It will be broadcast, and it will be available at the Arizona Society offices, and we'll be talking about that, and we should spend, like in Boise, I expect it'll be about 5 hours of that 8-hour course. It's going to be devoted to the 199 Cap A issues. That's the big issues. I'll be doing the full Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in both St. Thomas and St. Croix. I'm going to go spend some time on the beaches. You know, they're down there. And I'll be picking up a few other courses in Indiana. By the way, the 199 Cap A course I'm going to do in Phoenix the day before Thanksgiving. I'll be doing that course in December in Minneapolis, actually in Bloomington, Minnesota, at the Minnesota Society offices. So we'll have that one coming again. More Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, along with current federal tax developments here in Phoenix coming up in December. So we got lots happening. Check your state CPA societies. There are tons of courses. By the way, if you have not gotten you a full course on dealing with 199 Cap A, get it. Find something. That area is complicated. There's a lot of things to look at. Find yourself something where you're going to go in a deep dive on 199 Cap A. That is extremely important for this year. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for this past week, you know, for the coming week, I should say, of November the 5th. You can catch our updates. I hope to get to writing more now that things are calming down a little bit on the travel function on the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com site. You can also find questions. You can send questions and comments to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I do go on Twitter at Ed Zollers. I'll post there from time to time. And I follow discussions on the Reddit group r/taxpros. Also follow discussions on the state society groups run by the Arizona Society, New Jersey Society, Minnesota Society, and the California Society's Tax Talk, which is open to pretty much everybody. So if you want to get on, write some things. By the way, all those places are good places to kind of bounce ideas around. They're also not bad places, and I'll keep an eye out. You want to post a question, post it there. I really like to prefer to answer questions in places like that because that way other people get to, you know, participate in the discussion and also get a gain something from our interaction. And I always think that that's best when we're doing this thing. You know, it's really best to do it that way. So again, post your questions there, please. Again, don't put private information up there, but the law questions, no problem. With that, you know, we're still waiting on those 1,000 pages of proposed regs this month. So that'll be great fun when they come out. We're waiting on whole bunches of other things. So take care. Remember, you're out of tax season now. Don't forget to renew your P10. Mentioned that last week. And we'll see you next week here on Current Federal Tax Developments.